All right. What's up, everybody? Happy 2019. More Wildlife Cake and Cocktails coming at you. Very happy to be back. We've got lots of new episodes with some incredible guests already lined up for the year. Lots of interesting species and field shows already in the works. I think we're going to be talking Australian sawfish fairly shortly. We're going to be talking sea snakes. There's some pretty cool stuff on the horizon. I'm here with my producer, Christian Summers. How you doing, Christian? We got a bit of a different show coming up today.
That's right, Yanni. So this was actually your suggestion. I can't take credit for this.
Well, look, I mean, you know, in the interim, while we maybe can't always get one of our full shows out with a lot of guests, it's nice to kind of approach some of these topical things, I think, and maybe just get a bit of a discussion going. So I guess we're kind of trialing a bit of a new segment here, discussing current wildlife and conservation topics, just getting them out as soon as we can. Yeah, so I mean, it's all very experimental, but we're also very I guess interested in this stuff to hear your opinions out there. And look, any new research or developments that we've missed, feel free to let us know. But we might even choose some of your points to include in our next discussion. So please leave your comments down below and follow us on Facebook at Wildlife Cake Cocktails, at @WCC_podcast on Twitter, and at @wildlife_cake_and_cocktails on Instagram. We got to change that. You know, we got
to
change that.
We need to make that a little easier, don't we?
And you can also subscribe to the show on Podbean, SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, YouTube, and so on. So let's get into it. Guys, happy 2019, first of all. Summer down here in Australia, obviously. We're sweating here indoors already. It's 2 o'clock, so it's like heat of the day. We've got no aircon on for audio purposes, which is great.
Or fan.
Yeah, no fan, no nothing. It's been hot, man. There's been some heat waves, right? You've been struggling down this side of town?
I have been struggling. Our air conditioner broke, I'd say, about 2 weeks before the heat wave.
Yeah, excellent.
And we haven't had much rain, have we? It's been very dry down here.
It finally looks like we're going to get a bit of a break over this week.
Right.
So it looks like there's finally going to be some storms in at least in our side of town. I know up north and obviously in WA, there's been a little bit of monsoonal activity. So that's good. Definitely hoping to see some rain on this side of town. Look, as for the heat waves, it's been hot, man. We've been breaking heat records all over the place. Just as an example, Thursday 24th, 2019, Adelaide City broke its record at 46.6 degrees Celsius. That's the hottest of any state capital in 80 years of record keeping.
Wow.
Yeah. The Cairns heat wave last year from 25th to the 27th of November was one of the kind of first big ones of the year in 2018. And that was a particularly nasty one. Now, one of the reasons we really want to talk about these heat waves is bats. A lot of our large fruit bats in particular really struggle with temperatures, you know, above 42 degrees Celsius. Once they start to getting into the 40s, they're going to really struggle. Once they hit over 42, a lot of them are going to be in distress. With Cairns hitting, 42.6 degrees Celsius, there was a pretty massive mortality of spectacled flying foxes. That's Pteropus conspicillatus. We'll put a link up to that one. I'm sure I butchered that horribly. they're vulnerable underneath the Environmental Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act of 1999. And Western Sydney Uni researchers actually estimate that about 23,000 died in that heat wave.
Oh, far out.
Yeah. It could even be closer to around 30,000.
So that's just estimates.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is estimated from what they could find, obviously. And, there's going to be plenty that were missed, which is where the estimate might go. 30,000, maybe even higher. But their population estimates were already only at about 75,000.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're talking, you know, a quarter to maybe a third of the population in one heat wave over a couple of days.
Ouch.
Yeah. So that was a tough one. Look, even down south in Adelaide on the 15th of January, black-flying foxes, Pteropus alecto, I got to learn how to say that properly. Around 10,000 of them succumbed to the heat in the Adelaide Parklands with temperatures of around 42.2. The black flying fox, they're not a threatened species like spectacled flying foxes are. You find them all the way, I believe, up into Indonesia.
Right.
Yeah, they're a fairly widespread bat, but, I mean, all of them are important for ecosystem function, right? a lot of them are really important pollinators. And in fact, you know, a lot of our rainforest wouldn't really exist without the constant pollination by a lot of those large fruit bats and blossom bats and things like that.
And I would assume the spreading of seeds?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So pollination, seed dispersal, and I'm sure in general their guano also provides a bit of nutrient recycling.
Yeah,
as well,
absolutely.
Right? So there's a lot of those. You could essentially say that if you, kind of link them together, without the bats, you wouldn't have a rainforest. And, you know, without a rainforest along that coastline forming many millions of years ago and continuing to, you know, have this amazing effect on the nearby coastline, you probably wouldn't have such a barrier reef, right? So you need that rainforest to provide that those inflows to you know, over many millions of years for that reef to really form to that level, as I understand it. So the drivers of the rainforest health, the bats, are also very, very important for reef health.
All right. Just a question that popped to mind, Yanni. Are the bats particularly prone to heat stress as opposed to other sort of native animals?
Well, look, they are large. You know, first of all, they're fairly large animals. So I imagine
they're dark.
Yeah, and large, dark, and nocturnal mainly. Mm. Right? They do a lot of their activity at night. And they are mammals, right?
Yeah.
We struggle at 42 degrees.
We struggle way before that.
Yeah, absolutely. Don't we? There's a lot of workplaces, schools, public spaces that will, you know, basically send people home. You know, kids aren't going to school over a certain degree. If it goes over 40, I think a lot of schools, if it goes over like 35, you don't have to go to school. And things like that. You know, there's temperature limits to what even the human body can tolerate. And I think, I'm not sure what specifically it is about bats. We'll have to get somebody on to really nail that one down. Perhaps it's the colony roosting. You know, they roost in such big colonies together that there's a bit of kind of combined body heat or something.
But yeah, the sharing of heat and that concentration of body heat.
Yeah, exactly. But I imagine that bats are smart. They've also got efficient ways to thermoregulate somewhat with flapping and licking and evaporative transpiration, cooling down and stuff. But there's only so much that they can do. So pretty incredible to see. So many of them going down in such a short period of time, right?
It's very heartbreaking. And that's just hearing about it. We're not on the front line seeing this ourselves. And I'd imagine that would be quite a difficult thing to really see and to come to grips with.
Yeah. There's a lot of fantastic bat volunteer groups out there and rescuers doing some amazing work. But one of the other things to that is, you know, it's a bit of an unfortunate thing to have to be a reminder of is that Australian bats can actually carry some human transmissible diseases.
Lyssavirus,
Australian bat lyssavirus, which is I think pretty much the same family as rabies. I think most, I don't think there's been a case where somebody actually contracted the virus and survived. I'm pretty sure it's pretty much lethal once it gets up in that brainstem and starts messing around. So it's not something that you want. I'm, seeing as how I work with wildlife, I work with a range of wildlife that may potentially have to work with bats and have had to work with bats, I have to keep my Australian bat lyssavirus inoculations up to date.
I was just about to ask, so there is specific vaccinations for that?
Absolutely. And those workers out there, they're the ones that are going to be, all of them will have to, keep their keep their injections, but there's still a chance that immunization is basically based on herd immunity, so the individuals can kind of still slip through the cracks even if you are immunized. So if you get bitten by a bat that or scratched by a bat that is confirmed to have a contagion, then that bat pretty much needs to be euthanized and quarantined immediately so they can study it. And one of the unfortunate things is it's really hard to kind of identify if bats have lyssavirus. A lot of the time you need a brain slide.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So if you get bitten by a bat and you go, oh, God, I got bitten by a bat, I don't know if it has lyssavirus. A lot of the time the only solution is, well, we need a brain slide of the bat. So that's why not only do you have to have your shots, but bat workers have to be incredibly diligent and very, very, thought out in their methodology of handling and transport and how they avoid getting bitten. You don't want to get bitten or scratched. But when a lot of these animals get into heat stress and fall down out of the trees, they're now going to be in and around, on the ground, first of all, but also in and around urban areas some of the time. So I believe even the parts of New South Wales, there was warnings for the public for, to be aware that there'd been a few incidents where people got scratched and bitten by bats that were in heat distress and down low or behaving abnormally. So that is kind of a second potential risk that comes from all of these heat waves as well, which, you know, again, we're not trying to disparage the poor bat.
No.
But one of the things I would say is, you know, if you do see one in distress, definitely call, a wildlife carer. There's numbers like 1-300 animal.
Animal, yeah, that's the
RSPCA
one.
Wildlife Rescue Line and all these other numbers that we have here. And look, if you look online, you can usually find a local wildlife carer who will know the procedure for bat handling and rescue. So, members of the public don't have to do it themselves and put themselves at that risk.
Mm. Lucky for them, they do a great job.
They do.
Don't they? Anytime I've had to contact them for whatever reason, a baby minor bird fledgling on the road or...
Yeah, look, they're working as hard as they can. But again, look, when you've got this many animals coming down in these heat waves, and it's not just bats, obviously there's going to be a lot of other animals in heat distress during these kind of times. A lot of these organizations are run off their feet. They're just pushed to breaking point. So look, they really deserve everybody's support. I encourage everybody to look up your local, not only wildlife carers, but definitely people in bat rescue, particularly up north in the sort of Cairns-Townsville area. I think that they could definitely use it.
Cheers to them.
Yeah.
Well done, folks. Thank you.
Now, keep piling it on, but so we've got some more, heat wave associated issues. Over the last couple of months, in December and January, first of all, on the 17th of December, in the Menindee region of New South Wales, there was about 10,000 fish found floating along a 50-kilometre stretch of the Darling River, mainly native species including bony bream, Murray cod, very large, long-lived Murray cod, beautiful fish, as well as golden and silver perch and a lot of others. And about 10,000 of them were estimated to be found by New South Wales District Fisheries Officers. On the 7th of January, there was another massive fish kill along a stretch of about a 20-kilometre stretch of the Menindee Lakes near Weir 32. And this was in the hundreds of thousands. And it keeps getting worse. On the night of January 27th, this time above Weir 32 near Menindee, locals reported thousands of fish all gasping for breath after a third mass death in a matter of weeks.
And like I said before, we're not on the forefront. We're just seeing footage. We're hearing about it. We're reading about it. But and perhaps you might have seen the footage of that gentleman. I think he was a reporter talking about, I think it was the first of those die-offs 2 weeks ago or so. And he said the smell.
Yeah.
The smell was just, it gets into your bones and it makes you just ill to the core.
Well, not only that water is toxified, right? It's actually it's toxic to livestock because of cyanobacteria. So, look, these events are. I'll just put a caveat here. First of all, we're not hydrologists.
Absolutely so, not. So, confirm that.
These aren't like the authoritative findings. This is just, based on basically what I've read and my opinion.
Our conjecture, basically.
largely. But a lot of these, there is a debate as to how much of this is caused by just the current climate conditions or mismanagement of the Murray-Darling Basin. And the needle seems to be swinging towards mismanagement largely. We'll get to that, but we got to get there through a bit of a roundabout way. I'm not even sure if I asked you this before. You know the term eutrophication?
I don't think so. No.
Okay. So let's just go through this quickly. Eutrophication is how these river systems die a lot of the time. Typically, we understand it as a water body gets overly nutrient rich. It gets enriched somehow. Let's say, for example, Fertilizer runoff.
Yeah,
that's kind of how we typically think of these things. It relates to all the plant and algal, so plants on the bottom and algae in the water column having just a massive bloom and growing to massive populations. Unfortunately, they can't survive forever. They slowly start dying. They also potentially even start filling up the water column, so not enough light can penetrate, and some of the plant life at the lower level can no longer survive because it's not getting enough light. So the algae and the plants start dying. When that happens, bacterial decomposition takes over rather than photosynthesis from the algae and plants. Now, bacterial decomposition requires oxygen. So that depletes oxygen from the waters, and it also produces toxicity in those cyanobacteria. So there's a lot of factors involved in this stuff.
So the metabolic waste of the bacterial decomposition.
Yes, absolutely.
Yep.
Now, there's a lot of factors, again, temperature, light, and stratification of the water. If the water's stratified and layered and not mixing,
right,
then you can get pockets down the bottom near the riverbed or lakebed that are more deoxygenated. Deoxygenated water, cold water, for example, sinks. You get cold deoxygenated water and things die down the bottom of the bed, and that kind of increases the process. So stratification also not good.
That's ugly.
Yeah, it is. Now, Australia's got a long history with cyanobacteria blooms. In fact, the eutrophication, I think the term might have started here in a paper by Francis from 1878. And we've obviously had large amounts of blooms throughout the 70s and 80s, and a lot of it affecting farming communities, you know, livestock just dying by the thousands, unable to drink water or drinking it and then dying. Throughout the early 90s, there was management teams set up, but a lot of them fell short basically because we didn't have a good enough understanding of what's driving these processes. So a couple of R&D programs were commenced, the CSIRO Blue-Green Algal Program and the National Eutrophication Management Program. And since then, we've kind of come to a bit of an understanding about Southeast Australian impounded rivers in particular, where stratification and light penetration are actually the main triggers for the blooms. It's not so much the nutrients. Nutrient, it seems to be a limiting factor. So nutrient exhaustion limits the total biomass of the bloom.
Right.
But what triggers it is that stratification and the amount of light penetration. So an important factor is, I guess, initial turbidity. So turbidity is how much there is suspended in the water column blocking light, how cloudy the water is.
Right, yeah, right? Yeah.
That's actually initially important. If you look at some of our inland freshwater rivers, they're kind of cloudy. You know, they're a bit muddy looking.
Muddy, yeah, say muddy.
But that's not necessarily a bad thing in our systems because of, I guess, the rate at which they flow through, which is very slow. You don't actually want that water to be crystal clear and allow all that sunlight through, because then you get a bloom of all that plant life. And once you actually want that plant life to somewhat be regulated, that algal growth and that plant growth can't have that massive bloom.
Fascinating.
Yeah. So turbidity is also very important. So of course, how do you kind of counter these things? Well, with inflows. Inflows do two things. They do a bunch of things. They'll de-stratify the water, first of all.
Right,
so if there is deoxygenated pockets down the bottom, inflows mixes up the river.
Yep, mixes it through, yeah.
Turbidity. So as you've got things flowing in, you've got more suspended solids going into the water and increasing the, I guess, how cloudy the water is,
yep,
which will decrease some of the light, creating light available to produce those blooms. And, of course, it'll add fresh oxygen to, it'll add oxygenated water to those non-oxygenated waters. Really, really important. So environmental inflows are really, really important. Now comes the sticky wicket. Why are these deaths occurring now, right?
Yeah. Why now? Why ever?
Why ever?
And why now?
Yeah. So we obviously have a long history of eutrophication in this country, but a lot of those have been regulated by those natural inflows and as well as by, I guess, regulated flows as well. There has been, some environmental releases made from dams and such in the past. But I guess one of the sentiments kind of is it's largely based on drought, and that we can't control the weather, which that's kind of seems to be the governmental response. Hey, we can't control the river, we can't control the inflows, which seems like a fair assumption. Australia is in an ENSO cyclical drought cycle. So our El Nino periods are like sometimes last for 7 years worth of drought. And I think we're in some parts of Australia, New South Wales and Queensland, I actually made some notes here. Some parts are in between 1 and 7 years of drought. So it's initially kind of plausible, but when you examine it further, and the Australian Institute actually did a really, really interesting paper on this. The Australian Institute's a think tank conducting public policy research on topics like ranging from economical, social, environmental, basically trying to improve public debate and transparency, public discourse and democratic process. They put out a paper called A Fish Kill Q&A. So it looks like a fish called Quanda, they actually opened it with a fish called Wonder joke, you know, where the guy like has got a strap down and is like eating the fish. Have you seen a fish?
I've not seen it. Okay, we're gonna watch a fish called Wonder. Sure.
Just opening, it's a discussion paper by Marianne Slattery and Roderick Campbell, released this January 2019.
All right, very recent.
In opening, hundreds of thousands of native fish have died in recent weeks in the Menindee Lakes. Drought is the catalyst, but policy failure and mismanagement are the cause. Both state and federal governments and water agencies are responsible for this disaster.
Hmm.
So I guess the next question comes is how. You know, those inflows are needed, but is all the water gone from drought or mismanagement?
That's an interesting question. And is it safe to say that drought is somewhat a factor?
Drought is absolutely a factor.
Yeah.
Drought conditions lead to more eutrophication just in general because you have less inflows and, you know, but there's been a couple of things, have been very interesting. And I think one of the things to look at here is some of the drainages from the Menindee Lakes area where a lot of these fish die-offs are happening,
mm-hmm.
right? So in 2016 and 2017, they basically released two Sydney Harbour's volume. So each time, I think, close to 400,000 to 500,000 gigalitres worth of water from the Menindee Lakes.
That's really difficult to comprehend, isn't it?
While similar to some other releases, such as in 2014, these are ostensibly releases for agriculture and for the river's health and yada, yada. But there was no... I believe there was none of those releases were specifically tagged for environmental purposes. I'll have to check up on that.
Sure.
The interesting part is, you know, while those releases have happened before, they haven't happened in times when there hasn't been inflows from the northern catchments. So there hasn't been replenishing flows from the northern part of the Murray-Darling Basin. Now, we've got a large amount of irrigation going on in the Murray-Darling Basin, particularly in throughout the northern parts.
Right, yep.
Large amounts of it are for things like cotton cropping, which are not very water-efficient processes, particularly on a continent like Australia, which is maybe not designed for that kind of agriculture, but nonetheless, it's going ahead for now. And those inflows from the north have declined. What there isn't is a whole lot of transparency. There's pretty much no monitoring of on-farm water storage for those large irrigators. And there's also no public transparency to it. There's no public record of how much water is stored on farms.
Right, that's interesting.
That being said, you know, one of the arguments that, you know, these releases should not have been made because they were way in excess. I think there was a claim that South Australia needed that water for their farming and, you know, that South Australia was the one who pulled the plugs on the Menindee Lakes, as it was phrased. But South Australia at the time had just been through a massive wet period and was dealing with flooding. So those releases were well in excess of their requirements and actually not required. So,
okay.
When you have that on the table that, hey, South Australia needed it for their requirements and you take away you can no longer play the card that it was for environmental purposes. You just said it was for South Australian agriculture. So, there goes that card as well. One of the other arguments put forward was, it was based on modeling. We did these releases based on modeling and now we're arguing whether or not those models were right or wrong. Well, first of all, they were wrong, but the reason they were, it's not that the models were necessarily wrong. One thing we know about modeling, and this is a very, very, computer modeling, I mean, but I don't know much about
that kind of modeling.
Yeah, catwalk modeling. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about computer modeling. There's a very, very important and very well-known phrase, crap in, crap out, which means it doesn't matter how intricate, how beautiful, how efficient, or how accurate your computer model is, it chews in data and craps out a result. So if you put bad data in, you're going to get an inaccurate result.
And if it's not considering all the parameters as
well? If it's not considering all the parameters, that's a problem in the model, for sure. But if you have no transparency on the amount of water that's being held on the farms, then what kind of data do you have to put into the model?
Yeah, absolutely.
So you get crap in, crap out.
Yep.
In terms of business management, I believe the phrase is you can't manage what you can't monitor.
Hmm.
And there seems to be no intention to monitor how much on-farm storage is done in the northern part of the basin, even when all of this stuff is going on.
Why is that, you think?
There could be a number of reasons, and there's been a number of reasons stated, such as corruption was one.
Right.
Corruption was straight up one that South Australia got particularly interested in after a report by the Australian Investigative Journalism Program, Four Corners, in 2017 that uncovered that New South Wales irrigators were taking billions of litres earmarked for those environmental flows. Mm. So as those environmental flows were occurring, it was being pulled out of the river and not reaching those parts of the river that it needed. It was simply being used to irrigate. A subsequent report found there was poor levels of enforcement and, again, lack of transparency surrounding water management in New South Wales and Queensland. That actually sparked a massive outcry in South Australia, and at the end of it, they ended up putting in a royal commission. The results of that Royal Commission came in this week. Were handed into the South Australia government, I believe, yesterday or the day before.
Right, very, very recently.
Today is the 30th.
30th.
Wednesday the 30th. So I believe tomorrow, on Thursday, that Royal Commission becomes public. And a lot of the early signs are swaying towards mismanagement already. You can read about that, I believe, in The Guardian. It sparked a big outcry from South Australia, that's for sure. And I believe there's been new calls for since then, a national royal commission on not just a South Australian governmental commission,
but a nationwide
royal commission for the Murray-Darling Basin and how it's been managed.
Mm.
So, you know, that's an interesting one because, you know, in these times of epic climate disasters and catastrophes already starting to unfold, there seems to be the need for us to have a royal commission for people to not drain one of our most important rivers.
Yeah, catchment systems, yeah.
Yeah, which are super important. And obviously you can, if these fish die-offs are a result of those management decisions, oh boy.
It's not a good look.
No.
And yeah, it's quite concerning. And I think I've at least observed that this has become a very politicized issue, hasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. There was already, I believe the Murray-Darling Basin Authority released a statement saying that they were confident the Menindee Lakes have been operated using the best information available, and that the Australia Institute report was narrow in view of the operational issues. I guess we'll have to see what the Royal Commission says. As for the author of the Australia Institute discussion paper, we've got from a statement from Australia Institute senior researcher Marianne Slattery, and I quote, "It is clear what has caused the Darling River fish kill: mismanagement and repeated policy failure. To blame the fish kill on the drought is a cop-out. It is because water releases were made from the lakes when this simply shouldn't have happened."
Interesting, because I listened, in fact, to a statement made by the water minister himself, which he essentially attributed almost 100% of those issues to just drought, and it's completely out of our control. Droughts happen all the time.
Yeah, exactly, and we're back to what was the initial argument? We can't control the weather.
Yeah.
Which we've worked through and seen that there's been a number of mismanagement, a number of massive releases of water during times when they were, first of all, not required for and not earmarked for environmental reasons.
Yeah, and it's interesting that it seems to be okay.
In retrospect, they were environmental, apparently.
Allegedly.
Yeah. But at the same time, there's a royal commission onto the amount of water being pulled out by irrigators. And I guess as one final little note, I believe at the, despite all this drought, 2017 to 2018 was the third best cotton growing season ever, according to the Rabobank records.
Well, that's interesting, isn't
it? Yeah. So during the middle of the drought, they're having their third best cotton season ever, but at the same time, there's no transparency into the on-farm water holding.
Their consumption, yeah.
Yeah. And, of course, the modelling's perfect. We use modelling, so, of course, you know, we know what we're doing.
Oh, dear.
So, look, it seems we're all stuck in a bit of a pickle with this one. The fish are dying, the lakes are deoxygenating, and I believe the Menindee lakes are down to about 2.5%. They do a lot of that, by the way. A lot of those releases is one of the arguments was to minimize loss of water through just evaporation. You know, if the surface area of the lake is smaller, there's going to be less evaporative transpiration. Around.
Hang on, Yanni, that's the solar panel guy. So just give us one moment.
Solar panel guy's here, everyone. We'll check back with you in a bit once we see how the solar's going.
Sorry about that, folks.
And we're back.
And I was wrong. Sorry. It was it's actually the gentleman about the air conditioning.
Oh, so you're actually not going to be sweating it up?
Hopefully not.
Yeah, we'll see.
But if I do, well, too bad.
No, you've been living with it for this long. Yeah. You get used to it.
Just lots of bottles of cold water in the freezer. Yeah.
Well, look, I think, that was actually pretty fortuitous timing because I think we've pretty much, we've come to the end here with, the Royal Commission coming out, the South Australian Royal Commission into the Murray-Darling Basin Water Management coming out tomorrow and calls for a national Royal Commission into the Murray-Darling Basin, I believe. I may have all of that wrong. Again, these are not the official findings. These are just what we've found and decided to present and discuss.
I'm interested to see what sort of consequences there will be and what sort of enforcement in order to stop these things from happening again in the future.
Again, quite obviously for me, one of the things is that transparency and that public record of how much water is being held on farms, on site, and how much water is being taken out of the rivers for irrigation, because without that, the modelling is kind of bunk, right? If you don't have data to feed into the model, or accurate data,
we're just stabbing in the dark, aren't we?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You can't rely on models if you're not willing to go and collect the data.
Yeah, we don't want our models to be a sham, do we?
Yeah, no, that's it. That's it. Or wasted. Because, look, arguably those models are fantastic and they work fantastically well, right? Arguably. You know, hydrogeological modeling is a very, very complicated, very technical field, well outside of my realm. But... It is it's a long-standing field. It's something that we understand. But if you don't have the data to put in because there's a lack of transparency for whatever reason, whether it's corruption or just a lack of our understanding of how inflows happen, that needs to be found out. And you can't just say, hey, we did some models and it didn't work out. Sorry, too bad. Because
that's not good enough.
It's not acceptable. No.
Absolutely. Absolutely agree. And we need to do our best. It's okay. We're humans. We make mistakes. Things go wrong. Sometimes it gets ugly. But it's up to us really to do everything we can to ensure that we learn from it.
Yeah.
And we take steps to try and, you know, mitigate any damage we're causing to the environment.
Yeah. Look, we are living in a country that has, at least, you know, since our records for a long time, you know, has a long history of this kind of eutrophication happening in our agricultural food basket regions. So we owe it not just to the environment and all of these fish, but to our continued agricultural prospects somewhat as well to keep a healthy ecosystem in the Murray-Darling Basin.
Absolutely, and really strike that balance.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, guys, I think we're going to have to wrap it up there. Please do jump on below and let us know what you think in the comments. We'd love to hear them. Again, we're going to try to have a bit of a run through, get back to as many of you as possible, and maybe even pick a few to include at the start of our next discussion session. Follow us on Facebook at Wildlife Cake Cocktails and check us out on Podbean, SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, YouTube, and so on. And we shall be back with some more Wildlife Cake Cocktails very shortly. So some excellent shows on the way for 2019. Thanks, guys. Let us know what you think about our new segment here as well. And cheers. We'll be talking soon.
Thanks, folks. Yeah, feel free to contact us. Contact me, email, message our page, whatever. We'd love to know what you think. Hope you enjoy, and we'll talk to you all soon. Thank you very much.
Happy summer, guys. Stay cool.